is in the base of the antenna if it was manufactured well. Now it doesn't require anywhere near as substantial a ground plane. There's many a person using a 5/8 wave antenna, using nothing as the ground underneath it, but the metal railing of the balcony of their apartment, and it worked extremely well. And so that's a dual band antenna, where they call it two elements collinear on 2 meters, and that's a matter of interpretation. And yes, it's going to be more elements on 450, and as long as it's got the right impedance matching network, that can work like a charm. When you're on 450, you got to worry a little bit about the fact that four collinear elements is now going to have a much more narrow elevation pattern. If you could see that pattern in three-dimensional space, it would look like a pancake. And whether or not the antenna is sufficiently vertical so that pancake it puts all of that gain on the horizon as opposed to above the horizon or below the horizon because you've tilted it, that's something to concern yourself a little bit with. Also, inside of the apartment where you've got other reflecting objects around, you've got the dielectric constant of the walls, you've got metal by way of the wiring and the piping and everything else in the walls, the pattern does get a little bit more complicated. Anything you can do to make the antenna closer to a window on the same side of the building as the repeater you want to talk to, or to put the antenna higher up, like on the top of the building, if you had the ability to do that, it would make a huge improvement. If you had a balcony and you locate the antenna outside the building on the balcony, you'll get a huge improvement, because most residences are a little bit anechoic and a little bit lossy as far as the repeater.
Time out.
A little bit lossy as far as the signal getting from the outside world back into the living quarters. So there are people who like to protect their television aerial by putting it in the attic of the house. And yes, it protects it from the weather. And you may think that the rafters and the sheeting and the shingles on the roof are all dielectric materials and transparent. Well, it turns out they're only partially transparent. Every internal aerial inside of the house is going to give you quite a bit lower performance than the external antenna. So now you're back into the compromise of how much do you protect the antenna, how long does it last, versus how much performance you get out of it. Since most of these antennas don't break the bank, they're not that expensive, to get the higher performance by putting the antenna outside the house and accepting the fact that the weather's going to beat it up and you have to replace it every 10 years, that may be the lesser of two evils, if you know what I mean. Give you the most of the bang for the dollar, so to speak. So, good luck with that project. Does anyone else have any other suggestions for setting up EchoLink for Steve that you would like to give him? Give me your call letters and name at this time. K2LIW in the TechNet. Either there's not as many EchoLink people there tonight, or they agree with what you're doing and they don't have any further suggestions for you, Steve. Do come back and let us know how the project goes. And when you do that experiment, when you're going to be transmitting on your handy talkie, maybe to a particular repeater for EchoLink, you will find out it's a fascinating experiment to move around the handy talkie and find the desirable spots in the apartment, desirable orientations and locations for the handy talkie that gives you the best performance. And you'd be amazed how many people will move a handy-talkie around until they receive the best, and they assume that that means they're going to transmit the best, and they forgot about the fact that there is an offset in the frequency between to transmit and receive. Therefore, there's a different number of wavelengths between you and the repeater on the transmit frequency versus the receive frequency, and therefore the hotspots move around in a funny way. That's sort of the reason why your microwave oven, for instance, has a rotisserie in there, or it's got a stirring device, because whenever there's RF into a enclosure of some kind, there's going to be hot spots. And by moving the food on a rotisserie, you don't cook, you try to cook the food a little bit more evenly. And so it'd be nice if you had a rotisserie on your handy talkie in the apartment to run that experiment. Okay, Rich, I think, was the next person who signed in with a question or comment. N2EL, go right ahead, Rich, K2RIW.
Why do I want to comment on the EchoLink problem?
We'll get you in a minute, Joe.
40 on Howard's machine, 150 miles north of New York, in Phoenicia, New York. What were you, Barry? 41, I forget how many feet above sea level, but you were way up there on Wittenberg Mountain. Dick, what I wanted to comment, one, on open wire line. you know, I got such an improvement over coax. I found coax running non-resonant, even on 80 meters, is tremendously worthy. The open wire line made such a big difference, but I don't have any, what's the word I'm looking for, any point of reference that if I went to wider space open wire line, might I get even more performance? So you mentioned an interesting point that on 80 meters, the wavelength is so long. The open wire line I have, which is 450 ohm open wire line, it's about maybe an inch and three quarters spacing. I have seen there's a company, I'd have to go back on the internet, selling open wire line that's like 6 or 8 inch spacing. And years ago, E.S. Johnson used to sell ceramic insulators, which were either 6 or 8 inches, for making very wide open wire line. In fact, I saw some of those insulators on eBay. I let them go about a year ago. I should have bid on them. But there's somebody making that type of open wire line now. Do you think there's any advantage to it? I mean, what are the ramifications of 1 3/4 inch spacing on 80 meters, where the wavelength is so long? And what would I gain, if anything, by going to 6 or 8 inch space open wire line? Maybe Mel has some experience doing that. Back to that, and here we go.
Yeah, I've got a lot of comments on this one. But before we lose Steve, Joe broke in and said he's got some further comments on Echolink. So let me go over to Joe first. It'll be E2RYY. Go right ahead with your information for Steve, Joe.
Okay, very good, Dick. It sounds like the guy was testing this Echolink in his house. So he shouldn't be RF noising into his receiver that's receiving him. It sounds like he's got a gain problem, or if he has low mic gain on this radio transmitter he's using, like an HD, for example, it sounds like he compensated by turning up the gain on the Echolink apparatus, because there is an adjustment for your transmitter modulation and your receiver level that goes into the from the receiver to the Echolink unit that goes into the internet. So there's two different adjustments. I would suggest that what the guy tries, first of all, is listen to other people on Echolink. Go to a reflector or other Echolink nodes and adjust your volume till they sound okay. Once they sound okay, then take your apparatus and put it on Echolink's reflector system and adjust your audio till you sound the same coming back to yourself. And that way you get your transmitter and receiver audio levels probably somewhere close to the ballpark for adjustment reasons.
Yeah, let me ask you another question on this one, though, Joe. Let's assume now that my Echolink is a connection between a receiving radio and the internet, and I'm transmitting to that receiving radio in the same room with me, with, let's say, a handy-talkie. I see a possible problem of electromagnetic interference. Usually on an FM receiver, when you overload the daylights out of it and you give it a super strong signal, it tends to behave pretty well. A sideband receiver, you can't do that. You transmit in the same room to a sideband receiver, and you get a pretty yucky sounding signal. But FM can tolerate strong signals. As far as the reception into the receiving FM radio in the room with him. However, now that audio coming out of that radio is going into some kind of interfacing hardware, computer hardware or whatever, and eventually into the internet. Now, because the handy-talkie is transmitting a watt of power in the same room, depending on the shielding and susceptibility of that circuitry, it could be picking up RF and getting a different response than if a normal over-the-air reception in that radio was taking place. The fact that the transmitter is so darn close could be giving additional grief. That's a guess on my part, Joe. You've set up Echolink systems. I wonder if you've ever heard of anything like that. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet.
All right, you're talking about another different problem. You're talking about a conducted emissions problem where the RF and the HD is getting into the sound card or something in the computer and messing up the audio. That may be true. So the first thing I would suggest that the guy does is adjust the sound level to his transmitter listening on an HD, and the audio out of his HD sounds normal, coming from his mobile radio or the radio connected to the Echolink out to his HD. Get that audio adjusted first so it sounds okay. That's your starting point. And then go to set up the Echolink where you can go back to a reflector. It's very similar to IRLP, and I have an IRLP node on the air for a couple of years now. And then adjust the line gain or receiver gain going from the receiver, the audio channel, back to the sound card. And that's going into the internet. And once you have one adjusted, it'll be a lot easier to adjust the other one. If you think you have a conducted admissions problem, you're sitting there right in front of the computer transmitting on your HT, and you're distorting yourself, go to the other room and do it. That'll take care of that problem.
I like those suggestions. Okay. Let me turn it back briefly to Steve and see if he's got any further questions on what he just heard. KC2QFJ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick, and the other gentleman. I went through all that with the settings when I was first setting it up. That's what the purpose of the Echolink test server, getting their level. And what I actually found is when I set a level where my voice sounded good coming back to me, when I then tried to use the link with the DTMF tones, they weren't being decoded properly by Echolink software because the level coming, as it turned out, was too high. So I had to back off the level going back into from the link radio into the computer in order to get the built-in DTMF decoder to work properly. And that's when it made even worse, you know, the problem. But so it does seem really it's in this HT that I need to find a way to boost the mic gain. Really, I think, is the thing.
Back to you, Joe, if you got a suggestion on that one.
Well, it's my instrument. I mean, you may not have somebody available to service monitor, but maybe perhaps you might be able to locate somebody who's got equipment to be able to send a signal and receive a signal into your Echolink apparatus so you're receiving and transmitting correctly from the radio. It's always better to try to do it by instruments. If you don't have one yourself, try to get a hold of somebody who's got something. I mean, they can help you out that way. Because doing it completely by ear, you can really get out of left field very quickly with this kind of stuff.
Any other questions or comments? Jeff, you got it, Jeff. Correction, Steve. I'm terrible on names. You got it, Steve.
No, I think that's good for me for this evening. Thank you all very much for the information, and hopefully, I think my next check-in will hopefully be through that Echolink node. The purpose for me getting it set up is so that when I'm at my house up in Rhode Island on a Sunday evening, I can get into the TechNet. So hopefully that will work via the 375 machine.
Very fine. Just as an experiment, Steve, put your lips a fraction of an inch away from that microphone, talk very loud, and say a couple of words to me. Let's see what it sounds like.
I have pretty much been just a couple inches away from the microphone the whole time. In fact, I have my hands cupped around it to make a little echo chamber. Maybe a different angle to the mic. Is that any better?
And no matter what you do, your audio is half the volume it should be, in my opinion. So some form of adjustment is required. Occasionally what happens is the Electret microphone has a piece of felt in front of it, and maybe something got on that piece of felt that's acting like an acoustic attenuator, or maybe the mic itself lost gain, or maybe the particular handy-talkie wasn't set up correctly in the first place. What brand of handy-talkie and what model number is that? Steve, go ahead.
This is a Yaesu FT60R, Voxtango 60R, and yeah, that's exactly my impression, is that it's half the level that it should be. And I'm known to be a little soft-spoken, but I don't want to have to shout into the microphone, so I have to look for some adjustment. The only thing I saw on a menu was a wide, narrow setting, but I don't believe that's correct for my problem here, is it?
M2EO, it certainly is. You want to be on wide.
Go ahead, Steve. According to Rich, who does service of radios like that, the wide mode will give you a greater modulation. Back to you, Steve.
This is set up for 5 kHz deviation plus or minus.
Okay, we missed the first few words there, Joe. Are you saying narrow or wide is set up for 5? Press the mic, hold, wait a second or two, and then talk to us. Joe, go ahead.
Yeah, if that radio the guy's playing with has a setting in the software to go into narrow or wide, go for wide, because they are making these radios now to be compatible with, say, like FRS radio systems, for example, which are narrow band, or if you're running on splitter channels on the business band, you can reduce the deviation. Usually on narrow, the peak deviation is about 2.5 kilohertz, so if he's got it on narrow, no matter how you scream into the microphone, you're never going to get past 2.5. You got to make sure that radio is set to 5 kilohertz or wide deviation, and make sure the matching radio at the other end is set the same way.
Kilo Charlie 2, Mike, Blank Yankee.
Kilo Charlie 2, Mike, Blank Yankee. We'll get to you in a second. Steve, my recommendation is that you go to your menu for the narrow and wide, select the wide, and after I pick up with Rich into EO, come back a little bit later and give us some audio, and we'll tell you whether or not there's an improvement. KC2 Mike Blank Yankee, give us the full call letters and your name and your comment. K2RIW.
K2IRW, this is Kilo Charlie 2, Mike Hotel Yankee. Hey, Dick, this is Kevin, Kilo Echo Victoria, India, November. I'm operating off FT60R, and I tell the gentleman he should keep it on wide. I'm sitting up here in my living room with the rubber ducky antenna, so maybe you could judge his, judge my audio compared to his over there, Dick. I've been basically listening to you guys for a while, so I just think I'll give you a good demonstration there while I'm keyed up over here. Hey, K2IRW, KC2MHY.
Very fine, Kevin. Your audio is the right volume. You could use a little bit more RF, but there's a little bit of hiss in the background, but good audio. So looks to me like if you're in the narrow mode, Steve, you're going to want to transmit over to the wide mode. When you select that menu, make that change, come on back, and we'll let you know how it sounds. Okay, Rich. Now, when it comes to open wire line, Rich, first of all, if your antenna on 80 meters, if, for instance, you're operating on 3.75 megacycles, the middle of the so-called 80-meter band, 75-meter band, and it's supposed to be 131 feet long, and if it is some other distance, or if you're also using the antenna on a harmonic, like it's roughly 125 feet long and you want to use it on 40 meters at the same time, there's a number of ways that you can use an antenna so that it, on one of the bands you use it on, it is highly mistuned. At first, and one of the things that I naively said for a number of years, and you and Barry brought me up short on this one, is that because the coax cable on 80 meters, any reasonable piece of coax cable, is quite low and long, the fact that the transmission line is running at high standing wave ratio shouldn't be a problem if you've got a good antenna tuner that has enough range to it. Well, I was a bit naive on that one. When you get to these extremely high standing wave ratios, there's another factor that comes in with coax cables. There's a formula covering this, which is covered in the antenna handbook, particularly the software that they supply with the antenna handbook, and the antenna handbook, as well as the right chapter of the radio amateur's handbook, will show you a curve of basic loss of the cable versus the loss, the additional loss you get with extremely high standing wave ratio. And the bottom line of that, let me drop, is that when your standing wave ratio is extremely high, like for instance a 2,000 ohm antenna fed with 50 ohm cable, your antenna could easily be 2,000 ohms if you're using it on twice the frequency. An 80 meter antenna fed at 40 meters would give you close to a 2,000 ohm impedance. And 2,000 ohms on the end of a 50 ohm line is a 40 to 1 standing wave ratio. You put a 40 to 1 standing wave ratio on a reasonable piece of coax, and the insertion loss climbs rather fast. Even if you've got a balun, and the amount of voltage you'd be putting across that balun would be huge, and you'd be saturating it. So unless it's a super balun, it's not going to do the job. By comparison, if, for instance, you use 600 ohm line on that 2,000 ohm antenna, you've only got a 3 to 1 standing wave ratio, and now you've got three things in your favor. Number one, the open wire line is fiercely lower in insertion loss compared wire line is 450 or 600 ohms, and it is so much closer to the impedance of the antenna. It'll give you a hell of a lot less standing wave ratio, and you got less loss from that factor. And I forget what the third factor is, but you come out way ahead with open wire line. Now, once you go up to 450 ohm line, with let's say a 1,000 or 2,000 ohm antenna, you're going to pick up an improvement. If you then go over to 600 ohm line, larger diameter coax, a larger diameter conductors, and a greater spacing, and a 600 ohm impedance, you're going to pick up an additional improvement. Is the additional improvement half a dB or two-tenths of a dB? You go to the right formula and the right graph, you will find that out. And now you'll decide, is that extra two-tenths of a dB or 0.5 dB, is it worth the extra expense and the rigmarole of installing the 600 ohm line? That's your choice. And there's no simple answer on that one. But I think the improvement for the next step is going to be small, not huge, even though the improvement on the first step going from coax to open wire line was huge. So those are my feelings on that one. Drag your feet a little bit, Rich, in case other people have a comment on this one. N2EO with a little bit of delay. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, K2KEY.
Mel recognized. Anyone else? You've got it, Mel.
Hey. I've had a considerable experience with, of course, open wire feeding. And other fellows that were on 75, the loopers, as I used to call them, who punched them would get on with these full-wave loops, etc. And a lot of the fooling around with different feeders and different ideas and all. And a number of them had gone through the rigmarole of changing from coax then to open wire feeders to from 450 and then to 600 ohms. And there is definitely was improvement. In fact, one guy, he was fed up, he said, with the whole thing because he had gotten misinformation. And when he set up his loop antenna, he had to run some 300 feet of coax cable from the loop to his location of the shack. And everybody says, oh, you use open wire feeders, which he used to listen to. Some of these so-called experts on 75 told him, oh, no, open wire feeders for losses will be immense, the awesome, this, blow up your rig, you know, the whole work. And when he got on with us, and I sort of debunked the whole work, and he says, I spent a lot of money on coax. I said, well, you're going to have a lot of extra coax around. I said, because you put open wire feeders on that loop, and you'll see the difference. And I said, if you want to listen to the fellows on frequency that did the experiment, you'll find going to 600 ohm open wire feeders. Because the loop, actually, if you measure the loop, it's about 1,200 ohms. So using 600 ohm feeders, you right away have only a 2-to-1 difference stick over.
Whereas with coax cable, you'd have a 25-to-1 standing wave ratio. And that's a huge difference. 25-to-1 standing wave ratio is going to give you a tremendous increase in the insertion loss of the cable. Standing wave ratio really means what percentage of the power you send up the line is being reflected back. And a 25-to-1 standing wave ratio, I don't know what the exact number is, but maybe 95% of your power is reflected back. And the transmitter in that situation would be very unhappy, except the antenna tuner, if it has enough range to it, can rebalance that whole situation. That's the good news. But now with that high percentage of reflected power, what's really happening is the power is bouncing back and forth on your transmission line 20 or 30 times before it finally gets radiated. So whatever the insertion loss of your cable is, not only is it 20 or 30 times higher because of all those bounces, but there's some other funny skin effects that take place. And the formula that's in the antenna handbook, the CD-ROM that they give you, and also the graphs that they give you of the extra loss when you know the visoir of your cable will show you what that factor is. So going to the open wire line on antennas like that is definitely the right way to go. I used to say that the difference would be small, and I was very naive. I'm not as much of an HF operator as a VHF, UHF operator, and I had to be corrected on that one. Pass it back to you for that one, Rich. And by the way, Kent, WA5VJB, thinks he will not have the time to sign in tonight, but he wanted me to ask you this question. With your audio equalizer that you're using that's got 31 bands to it, let me drop. Most likely it and the circuitry connected to it has some additional gain. As such, were you worried about putting in a $100 impedance matching transformer to give a 300 ohm impedance on one side and 50 ohms on the other, or whatever? His recommendation was that a simple resistive impedance matching attenuator circuit. You set up the right values of resistors. You can make the input impedance of the resistors anything you want, and the output impedance anything you want. That's the good news. But the resistive network will have some insertion loss, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 dB. However, if your equalizer and other electronics has the right amount of gain, the fact that the insertion loss by the resistive attenuator takes place could easily be compensated. So I wonder, he wants to know if you've ever considered the simple approach of a resistive, so-called lossy impedance matching network to be used for your particular situation. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, K2RIW, TechNet, Limelock, N2EO. Well, I solved the problem. What he's saying makes sense. The equalizer does have a gain control, and I did have to back the gain down. It was too loud. And what he's saying makes a lot of sense, but I solved the problem a different way. Last week, I bought a transformer that goes in the line. It actually looks like a tip ring and sleeve mic plug with a wider barrel on it. You know, the barrel that would normally go over the wire. $16 free shipping, made by Technica. And it's got a nominal impedance, lower, it's on one side of the transformer. It has a female 3-pin XLR connector, nominal impedance of 200 ohms. And on the other side, which is tip and sleeve, it's got a nominal impedance of 50,000 ohms, and it's doing a good job of matching. What I was concerned with, and I think what he's saying would have solved it too, what you were talking about, what Howard was talking about, was that the microphone is a transducer. It's a mechanical device, and you don't want to alter the frequency response by dampening the movement of the diaphragm or whatever's in there. But I think I've achieved that, Dick. Everybody said on 2 meters, 440. Somebody heard me on 20 meters sideband last week on the Collins net, said it sounded good. The guys on 75 AM said it sounded good. So I think we got that squared away. As far as the open wire feeders, never let it recycle. See, here's the only thing. When Mel was saying with a 1200 ohm antenna, see, my dipole is a little short of a half wave on 75 meters. The total length set to center, the total length from end to end is about 110, 120 feet. So I would think maybe that's an advantage in this case. The impedance is probably lower than 50 ohms, or put it that way. I don't know what the impedance is, but maybe going to a higher impedance line might not be an advantage. What do you and Mel say, Dick?
What's your best guess as to what the true antenna impedance is, Rich? Because it's shorter than half wave, I think it suggests you're going to have a significant amount of capacitive reactance. And as you deviate from half wave, the resistive component goes down. So if at your particular altitude, the normally antenna would be 72 ohms resistive, and you've got it shorter, maybe you're 65 ohms resistive, and maybe you're 150 ohms capacitive reactance because you're short. And in that particular case, would there be a huge improvement when you go from 450 to 600? I think the difference is going to be small. Your situation could be a little bit friendlier than the full wave loop that Mel was talking about, where he had something like 1,200 ohms impedance. Let me turn it over to Mel for any further words on this one. And K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah. The loop, full wave loop, like I have 275 feet of continuous wire. Actually, the whole thing is made of one piece of wire. I go from the shack, from the tuner in the shack, through the wall that's using those feed-through that, the porcelain feed-through that uses the oil burner igniters. That's my feed-through through the wall. I go up to the antenna, 275 feet around the loop for six, eight supports. Come back, and then with the to this point where the wire originated, the feed line went up and originated back to that point to an insulator, and then down, and just with home brew stasis made out of pieces of plexiglass, that is the system, and then back through the wall again into a Johnson kilowatt matchbox. That's the layout. Now, if you go to something like what I used one time, a folded a V-type configuration, or what I may call, or just a V-type configuration dipole that I use. I remember measuring the impedance drops, or I should say increases, to approximately about 300 ohms. Now, actually, a V will be somewhere in the neighborhood of about 300 ohms, so you could actually use twin leads as a almost a perfect matchstick over.
Yeah, but he's asking if he goes from 450 to 600, will the loss substantially get better? Rich, go ahead.
I know what Mel is saying, make a fold the dipole. I originally had that, and I was using ladder line for the dipole as well as the feed line. The problem was, one day after running it with that amplifier for a number of months, I noticed the SWR jumping up. Barry came over and he said, you know, that thing is on fire on your roof. It actually burned open. So that's when I went to a straight wire.
Back to you, Mel, for any comments on that.
In the case of a classic dipole or a somewhat modified dipole like Rich is using, going to 600 ohm wire, I don't think is going to make much of a difference. In fact, I would say most likely he'd be better off staying in his situation down 450 ohm wire, because I assume the impedance of that antenna is less than 450 ohms, Dick. So I would say possibly maybe even 300 ohm wire would maybe be the better way to go in that situation over.
Rich, when you had fire on the roof, what was actually burning?
What was burning was sort of the ends of the wire, where the ends of the dipole, which of course where the high voltage is, with doubled back on itself, and I believe also at the feed point.
So it was plastic insulators that were arcing and burning? And was it just smoke or a real blazing fire?
Oh, the connections opened up. The solder melted, and I didn't see it, you know, because I couldn't be downstairs and upstairs at the same time. Barry went up there at night, and he said that the, maybe he remembers he was on frequency before, but I remember he when I got it down, you could see the solder connections were all melted.
And how were you feeding the antenna at that time? Was it open wire lines?
Some folded dipole made out of 450 ohm line, fed with 450 ohm line.
Interesting. I presume you were pouring close to a gallon into it at that time, is that true?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, that's an aggravating factor. 1,000 watts of power. And if it was sideband, which means you had at least 1,500 watts of peak envelope power, or key down, you had probably a healthy 1,000 watts. Everything's got to be working quite well for that kind of a situation, particularly when you got high standing wave ratio. So open coax in that situation would have really had a tough time. The coax would have gotten quite hot, in my opinion. So open wire lines, good stuff. There are people who are afraid of it because it looks so unshielded. There are people who are afraid of it because it's so hard to suspend it correctly. You'd like to not lay it up against metallic duct work and things like that. You'd like to use the right kind of standoff insulators that is going to be supported by the house. Quite often guys will run open wire line and make a great big catenary across the backyard between the shack and the actual antenna. So therefore you got a long length of unsuspended, unsupported transmission line. There are ways you can support it, but you got to be a little bit careful. Bringing it through the wall of the shack represents a little bit of a problem. Mel did it by using these porcelain insulators that are used for igniters for an oil burner. You go to an oil burner supply house, and for not very many dollars, you can buy porcelain insulators that can easily tolerate 10,000 volts. And feed those through the wall is one approach. Some people have chosen the right brand of coax cable and use a pair of coax cables fed through the wall. And with the right spacing between those, that picks up the open wire line rather nicely. Even though the coax cable will give you a short length of some other impedance, you study on a Smith chart what happens when you've got 2 degrees of electrical length out of 360 degrees, which represents a wavelength. You have 2 degrees of electrical length of, say, a 50-ohm or 100-ohm. If I use two pieces of coax cable side by side, shield to shield connected together, that is a 100-ohm twin lead system. And if I've got a 0.01 wavelength length of 100-ohm transmission line in the middle of a 600-ohm transmission line, and you study that on a Smith chart, you'll find out that your 600-ohm line will act like 580 ohms, if you know what I mean, with a tiny amount of inductance or capacitance. It's a rather minor perturbation if you do it for a short number of wavelengths. So,
repeater, timeout.
So a little bit of art and science is required to bring open wire line into the house and to properly insulate it and properly support it. But once you make that investment, there is no lower loss transmission line that you can get your hands on within reason. Anybody have any further questions or comments on this? Give me your call letters right now. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Comment, Dick. That's who we have.
Rich recognized. And was there another person? Okay. Rich, you got it.
Okay, Dick. What Mel did with the oil burner igniters, I know what oil burner igniters are. It's a nifty idea, but, you know, I found even with the parallels of running, I don't have to be that sophisticated. What I have is I made a hole a number of years ago in the side of the house with a circle hole cutter for coax. And I put a plumbing nipple made out of PVC through there, a feed through. So when I went over to open wire line, I just substituted the open wire line right into the PVC nipple. I've had no arcing, no problem.
Yeah, there's lots of ways of doing it once you understand the voltage you're standing off and the insulation you're going through. And to make it weatherproof, weatherproof as well as RF arcing proof and so on, it's not too difficult with the materials that are available, and it won't break the bank. So for these kinds of HF antennas, open wire line has got a lot going for it. For VHF frequencies, it's not quite as appropriate. First of all, we don't run into impedances that high most of the time, and even if we did, we would use a small impedance matching device right at the antenna, and the transmission line, my favorite kind of VHF transmission line is hard line. 600 ohm open wire line, when you go beyond, let me pick a number, 30 megacycles, it's going to start radiating on you, because the number of wavelengths of spacing between the wires is not small anymore. It's a rare individual who would experiment with an open wire line on, say, 2 meters. Steve K1FO did experiment with open wire line for the phasing harness of his 432 megacycle array of multiple Yagis. But in his case, the open wire line had a spacing of about a half inch, and I think they were made out of something like 12-gauge pieces of wire. So 12-gauge pieces of wire, half-inch spacing, probably was something like 100-ohm twin lead, and he did use that as a phasing harness arrangement on his 432 Yagi array, and it worked rather well. But you've got to keep the spacing a small fraction of a wavelength. If he did it with the normal multiple inches of spacing that you have on 600-ohm line, then his transmission line would be really part of the antenna. It would be radiating. Only when you've got a balanced condition, push-pull, equal voltage, 180 degrees out of phase exactly, and a small fraction of a wavelength, does it act like a shielded system. Okay, anyone else with any further questions or comments? Give me your call letters right now. K2RYW in the TechNet.
I think I wanted to make a comment on that gentleman's HT, the FT-60.
Go right ahead, Rich.
Okay, there's a lot of confusion as to whether to use wide or narrow FM. See, in the old days, wide was considered 15 kilohertz deviation, narrow was 5 kilohertz. So like Joe was saying, nobody uses 15 kilohertz deviation anymore. And so it's 5 kilohertz is considered wide, and they're using 2.5 kilohertz narrow in parts of the world, because these radios, and they all have that, are marketed worldwide. And Dick, you would mention adjusting pots, the deviation. There are no more adjustment pots in most of these radios. Everything is done in firmware. I, for instance, bought a new Olinco. They came out with something called the DJ-G7, which is 2 meters 440 and 1.2. And everything in that radio, not just the deviation, everything, all the alignment is done by going into a setup mode, using a service monitor, and manipulating knobs on the front of the radio. It can get you into trouble, too. If you hit the wrong menu and make a mistake, you can really get into trouble because it adjusts the IF. It adjusts everything. But I know that this Olinco I bought was very hot. Came through a little over 5 kilohertz without PL. And with PL, it was just too wide. So I had to back it down. Now, a few other people bought the same radio, and it came through just right. The deviation was right. So I think not only is the matter of setting it for wide deviation, at least in the United States, but a lot of these radios, it seems to be a variation on how well they set them up. Again, the K2RIW and 2EL.
So that 15 kilohertz of deviation that used to be used in the old days, I think you're saying, is gone. And wide nowadays means 5 or 6 kilohertz, and narrow means 2.5. And I've heard quite a few of those radios at 2.5. And with a normal receiver, it's a little bit low in audio output. And if you are using the right receiver, see, the nasty thing that happens with FM deviation on a receiver is that the amount of noise you get in the background and the lack of carrier changes considerably. You take, for instance, a hi-fi FM radio that works from 88 to 108 megacycles, which is set up for plus or minus 75 kilohertz of deviation. If you tune that in between stations, you hear a very gentle amount of hiss, and as such, a squelch control is not really required on an FM tuner. Whereas you take a 15 kilohertz radio receiver, FM kilohertz, 15 kilohertz FM receiver, and in the lack of carrier, it gets very noisy. 5 kilohertz gets noisier yet. 2.5 kilohertz, the noise will really blast you. So that's one of the disadvantages. You need a healthy amount of squelch action on a 2.5 kilohertz radio. And on top of that, it does have a peculiar kind of threshold. That is to say, if you're doing a sine ad measurement on a 2.5 KC radio versus a 15 KC radio, you'll find some very different characteristics. As you go to more and more narrow band FM, you're really putting less and less audio into those sidebands, less and less of the modulation is becoming a modulated signal as opposed to a carrier signal. And as such, even with a properly set up discriminator, you're not getting as much punch as you could have. The good news is that narrow bandwidth gives you a lot less noise equivalent bandwidth of the IF strip, but the audio output from the discriminator starts acting pretty loud, and there's a bunch of explanations for what's going on when you do that. And with any further questions or comments, give me your call letters, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2QFJ.
Go right ahead, Steve.
Yeah, I checked the menus, and it's been in the wide mode the whole time, so that wasn't it. Again, it really feels to me like an issue of mic gain, like how much voltage from the microphone is actually producing the deviation. Because as I said, when I was, I had set it up to where it sounded a good audio level, but the DTMF tones were then overloaded. In fact, I'm going to hit a tone here. Maybe it's much louder than my spoken audio. So I'm wondering if it's something like that. How did that tone sound? Very much louder than my spoken audio?
Yes, it is. Slightly louder than your spoken audio was that tone. So I think that's what you saw during the experiment you did with the EchoLink, and that's what we're hearing on this band also. Steve, go ahead.
I got a comment, Dick. Take a point.
Go ahead, Mel.
Okay. Is he using the electric mic that plugs into the radio? Can he unplug that and just use the speaker mic over?
You got it, Steve.
Yeah, actually, right now it is an extra speaker mic. Let me disconnect it and come back with the built-in mic on the face of the radio.
Yeah, I've seen a number of situations, Steve, where the built-in mic on the radio is a lot louder than the speaker mic. Let's see if that's in your case.
By the way, Dick,
I tested it both ways with the EchoLink, and I didn't hear a difference. But do you hear a difference now, KC2QFJ?
Yeah, the mic in the radio is a little bit louder, but not huge. Go ahead, Rich.
I would say the fidelity on the mic he's using now is better. Yeah, all these radios, I would say, I'm not telling Steve to send them to Yaesu, but I'm just making a general statement. At least in the case of the Olinko, the deviation was over 5 kilohertz, and my PL deviation was about 400 cycles, and I was, even after that 6th line mark, the tone decoder, I was still popping out. That was the fault of the radio, not the line mark repeater. And when I found to play him with the thing, it seems the best way to set these up is target value of about 4 kilohertz peak deviation with no PL, and about 800 cycles of PL on top of it. Go ahead, Dick.
And what about multi-frequency tones for touch tone? What deviation do you think those should be, Steve? Rich.
As you think, I had no interest in that. I didn't go into that, but I would think they should be, I don't know, but I would think they should be set up for probably between 3.5, 4, certainly no more than the 4 kilohertz, but I would say around that same peak deviation.
So the tone should be close to the audio, which is almost where he is now, and you are getting more fidelity on the mic built in, and I've heard that happen rather frequently. Those speaker mics tend to be a little bit lower in fidelity and a little bit lower in amplitude, so if you're able to use the mic on the face of the radio, I think you're coming out ahead. Try eating that mic and talking a little bit loud and seeing how it sounds. You got it, Steve.
Okay, so this is, a little louder and on the face plate radio. I'm not surprised that the speaker mic is a lower fidelity, but it's a lot more convenient than holding the radio all the time.
That sounds better.
That is full volume audio, Steve. Full volume. Now, when you properly set that up on EchoLink, I think you're going to be a lot happier. Back to you, Steve.
WB2XWW with a comment, please.
Howard recognized. Go ahead, Howard.
Yeah, your touch tone should be about 3.5 to 4 kHz. Touch tone should not be any louder than your deviation. It should actually be a little lower, and you have to look to make sure you have the right twist between the high group and the low group. Now, one thing you can do, you can check that radio. I'm on an FT60 right now. He can check to make sure the membrane, sometimes you gotta take, these radios are waterproof. So some people want to take the membrane out there. Go ahead.
Where's that membrane located? Just in front of the mic itself, Howard, or is it over the whole mic and loudspeaker? Back to you, Howard.
It's, they got it over the speaker, they also got it over the mic. So some people just take a little hole, puncture hole, be careful you don't go through everything. That's what they do. And I think the FT60 has a microphone level adjustment in software. I'm on an FT60 right now, Dick, so you can judge it. But you have to make sure the touch tone, and I was listening to the previous QSO. If the guy wants to connect to my repeater later on tonight, that's WB2HWW. Look me up. Or just click on WB2HWW. I have Echolink, and I'll help him out. I got a good ear for this. I have both Echolink and IRLP. And maybe I can help him set his levels up.
Boy, I want a comment about the touch tones.
Go right ahead, Steve.
With Joe.
Oh, okay. The person with the comment on the touchdowns, identify yourself and go right ahead.
You should try to keep the touch tones from clipping. Setting the touch tones to 3.5 to 4 kHz is incorrect. If you look at it on the service monitor, you'll start clipping your touch tone. If you set the deviation to either 4 or 4.2 kHz, you're not going to be able to get the touch tones to not clip. You should set the touch tones with like 3, maybe 3.3 kHz deviation maximum. You want the touch tones to go out without clipping the audio at all. They'll work the best that way.
Well, that's what I said, about 3.5 kHz.
Okay, that sounds awful good. Back to you, Steve, if you need any fill.
No, thanks everyone for the information. So, when I have... pretty much my cheek right up to the microphone here, I guess I get the best gain. So I'll have to look and see if perhaps there's a service menu I can access on the FT60. The menu that you get normally doesn't have anything for mic gain, because I would like to go back to using the external mic. Howard, as far as connect to your review, I will do that later on, maybe tomorrow or later on this week. I actually have that link set up at my QTH in Rhode Island where I'm headed to this evening. So when I get it all set up, maybe I can find you on the repeater, and it would be great to set those levels. So thanks, everyone, very much. This is KC2QFJ.
One more comment. It's a question for QSJ. Dick, QSJ, the touch tone decoder is in software. You're not using one of those interfaces with a hardware decoder. The touch tone decoder is part of the program in Echolink. Is that correct?
Roger. I'm using the internal Echolink DTMF decoder, and using the Echolink test server, I had set up my audio to where I thought I had a good level, but then the Echolink wasn't responding to the DTMF tones because it was over-modulated, so backing off the level from the link radio solved that problem.
KB1IFY, what a comment.
KB1IFY, Dick, let me make another comment, because I have run the software. Let me say one thing about that software. Using the built-in touchstone decoder, which is done in software, isn't that great. They don't react that well. They get confused. What you want to do is get an Echolink interface box that has a hardware tone decoder. You can select either software tone decoding, which is basically something that looks at the waveform, and I don't think it works as well. I have used both the internal tone decoder, which is in software, and I've used hardware tone decoders. You're much better off going out and spending $40 or $50 on the hardware interface that has a built-in touch tone decoder.
That sounds good. I think it's Bill from Stanford, KB1IFY. Is that go right ahead, Bill?
Yeah, that's correct, Dick. Good evening, all. KB1IFY. I just got one comment on the Yaesu hand mics for the HTs. You open up those hand mics in the front where the cartridge is, there's a piece in there. You take that piece out, and it brings the audio up on the mic, and they work much better. I had that with my VX5 and my VX6. I had the same problem. So I just thought I'd pass that along for what it's worth. Back to you, Dick. Bill, that piece that you removed, is that some kind of a waterproofing piece? Is it like a diaphragm that you took it apart when you opened up the handheld mic? Go ahead. Yeah, that's what it is. It's a diaphragm in there. You take that out, and the audio on the mic is much better. So it sounds like you get higher fidelity and greater volume. I wonder if that makes some sense, and if you need a fill on that one, Steve. QFJ, KQLIW.
Roger, yeah, that sounds like it would work as well. Actually, I don't. It's an aftermarket speaker mic going through an adapter, so it makes the situation even worse. So if I can't find mic gain settings somewhere in the menu, I'll just go back to using this faceplate built-in microphone, which seems to be better all around.
Hey, you got full audio volume there right now. Lots of it. Okay, that's got to make an improvement. Anyone else on frequency right now with any comments or questions, give me your call letters. We're going to wait long enough for the machine to fully drop. K2LIW.
WB2HWW with some comments on his touchtone decoder settings and software, Dick.
Okay, how we recognize? Is there anyone else? Okay, we gave it a long enough period of time so that somebody out of area could sign in. You got it, Howie.
All right, QSJ, there's a couple of things you can do. You can go into the software setting, into the administrative setting as a sysop on EchoLink, and you can change how long it takes to touch tone decoder to work, how long does the thing look at each touch tone. Increasing the length will help it and make it, you know, more sensitive. The second comment is this. If you can afford it or if you want to, I would go for the hardware solution instead of using a software touch tone decoder, because you've got to find out that it's kind of false. That what that means is that when you talk on your radio, that sometimes the EchoLink is going to say not found, or it's going to repeat back touch tone numbers to you. Apparently, the software touch decoder is not as selective as getting a device that has a built-in hardware decoder. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, thank you for all the information, Howie. I think we've gone through everybody's question that signed in tonight, Mel. So I think we're going to hit the mailbag a little bit earlier than usual, or any other comment you would like to make. K2KEY, K2LAW.
KC2RSF listening.
Mr. RSF, you have a question or a comment, sir?
Sir, just a quick question. I have an Icon 208H, and I'd like to, I'm not on that right now. I'm on an 8000 Icon 75 watt or VHF only. But on a 208H, I find a lot of the audio, the mic, could be a little bit better. Is there any way with a 133 Icon mic that you can raise the volume, anything you could do? I had looked in the manual, and I can't seem to see any kind of an adjustment. I'd just like to put comments and opinion, and possibly one of you with your knowledge would know if that's possible. Over.
Okay, let's see if Rich, Howie, or anyone else who is familiar with a 208H can help Tom. Give me your call letters right now.
Kilo Charlie 2, Mike Hotel Yankee.
Kilo Charlie 2, Mike Hotel Yankee. Start off with your name, sir, and your question or comment.
Yeah, I just wanted to help her. I think it's K2RSF. There's a venue on the ICOM 208H. It has something for Mike. Low and high. I didn't really know what it was. Hey, but Ray, W2DEA showed me. Cause when I first got the 208H, the audio on the mic there was